Thanks for joining us on the Port City Church podcast. More information about Port City Church is available at portcitychurch.org.
Hey, everybody, again, thanks again for being here with us today. I'm joined with very familiar face and voice in our church, Stuart Hall and his wife, Kelly. So we want to welcome you guys and thank you so much for being here. Many of you know and followed along with Stuart and Kelly's story, really their whole family, in his battle with COVID-19 and 27 days on a ventilator, 26 days on a ventilator. And we were talking yesterday, and one of the things that as we were entering into this time, part of what we've been talking about as a church is this idea of entering in and posturing ourselves to really be a part of people's lives. And as soon as we heard about this, I know one of the practices that I did personally, because it's easy when people are distant or you see a lot of numbers, you just sort of think of it, oh, it's somebody else or it's them. And having, you know, friends, and it was also, you know, Stuart. And so one of the things I would do in my journal as a practice was write down Stuart and Kelly and Grant and Chandler and Cameron and write your names down. To say your names as I was praying for you guys and to really realize that when I was here and sometimes unaffected, you were sitting in a parking lot with the blue heart in Stuart's room. And it really impacted me personally in a lot of ways. And when we were talking about we had already had Stuart scheduled to be here to do a series. And for those of you who don't know, Kelly kind of runs his management. That's the best way to say it, and schedules. And so I was trying to be really sensitive and not say, hey, Kelly, you know, I know Stuart was like near death, but like, can he come? So I was trying to be nice. I just said, hey, we're basically planning on not having Stuart here for these 3 weeks. And you sent me back an email and said, oh, he's determined to get to Wilmington, which is not surprising. But so I said, I'm going to drive to Atlanta because I want to see Stuart. And I want to see, like, if he's okay. And so we did a Zoom call because we didn't work out where I could drive down there. But we did a Zoom call. And I remember when I saw you on the screen, I almost, like, it was emotional to see you. I think it was, you know, obviously because of your story, but just having really felt and entered into that personally. So I say that because I think a lot of people in our congregation feel that way, and so to have you here is just a really, 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 you know, it's important for us, it's an honor for us, and so I just want to say thank you guys for being here, and so really just to start, you know, kind of how are you guys doing, and then we can kind of talk about the story and what progressed from there.
I was fine until you showed the video, and there aren't enough words for us to articulate how grateful we are. I think Kelly and I both, our children understand there's really not an explanation for why I'm still alive and why I'm here. I'm undeserving, but so incredibly grateful. And I want to say to men and women that are here live and those that are watching, there's no doubt in our mind that it is the prayers and love of those people, you guys in the greater Wilmington area, the faith community of Wilmington and all around the country. It's why I'm sitting here. And I'm just incredibly humbled and grateful. And the fact that we get to be sitting beside each other. This is the secret sauce.
And Kelly, how are you? I know it's like the journey probably in the middle was so acute and just day to day. And then now it's, you know, things kind of seem to be, has it all kind of come back or like what's the emotion kind of now currently?
Yeah, I think in the midst of everything, you're just in survival mode. And right now, probably for the last month, I would say, maybe a month and a half, we have really, me and my children, we just, the emotions come up in the very craziest times, and we all are in the process of working through the trauma, I guess, that we all experienced at the same time. Stuart feels I've gotten a new lease on life. Let's go. Yeah. And all of us are going, hold on. Yeah. We need a moment.
Yeah. Because you're going to hear, it was like, it wasn't just one day of, it was like up, down. Like
It was.
Biggest swings as you can possibly get.
It was.
So can you take us back to, I know I was asking Stuart to tell me the story, and you actually said,
yeah.
Well, all I did was lay there.
Yeah. I mean, I've had to, so March the 25th, I started feeling bad. Kelly and I try to walk every day. We had just walked 5 miles, and I just started feeling weird. We didn't really do anything about it until March the 29th and went to the emergency room. One thing that I think people need to remember, this is in the early onset right. of COVID-19. And the other thing that I think people maybe aren't aware of is that even in the early days, Kelly took me to the emergency room. I got out of our vehicle, and she had to go and sit in the parking lot. But they took me into the emergency room. They didn't have enough tests. I didn't have enough symptoms. They took an x-ray of my chest. Their words exactly were, we're 97% sure you have the COVID virus, but because you don't have enough symptoms and because we don't have enough tests, we're going to send you home to self-quarantine. So I went back home and stayed in my bedroom from that point until the time that I went back to the hospital. I progressively got worse. My fever would spike to 104. Kelly could get it down to 101 with Tylenol, but that was really difficult. April the 3rd, our general physician contacted an infectious disease doctor. That infectious disease doctor prescribed for me what has now become a controversial drug, hydroxychloroquine, and I took it, and for 3 days straight, I didn't sleep. I didn't sleep for 72 hours, and my heart started racing. We were avoiding going back to the hospital because what right. we knew is that if I get admitted, I'm going to get intubated, and she's not going to be able to be with me.
Right.
And Kelly kind of harbors a lot of guilt for this, but it wasn't her. I was being hard-headed and stubborn because I didn't want to go back to the hospital.
Yeah.
But eventually, on early morning, April the 7th, I just finally looked at her and I said, I think we need to go. And even on the way there, it got worse. In fact, she almost stopped at a fire station because she was worried about me. Our son was with us, but I get to the hospital. They do let her come in with me, and a very crazy long story short, I was either having a heart attack or had a heart attack once I got to the hospital. And I'll click out there because the last thing I remember is watching Creed in my bedroom on April the 6th that night. And then the next thing I remember is starting to come out of the fog in ICU. She had to tell me I had a heart attack.
Right.
I was like, what? But Kelly's right. Kelly, Grant, Chandler, and Cameron experienced all the trauma. I just was out of it. I had some crazy dreams that we won't talk about. But she and our children are the ones that experienced all the trauma.
Yeah. Yeah, so go ahead.
So that night when we dropped him off at, I had to, as soon as they intubated him, they kicked me out of his room with him. And I went to the waiting room, and nobody came in there. The first person that came to see me was a cardiologist. I'm like, okay. And he said, your husband's either having a heart attack or has had a heart attack. Is it okay if we go in and check it out? And I'm like, absolutely. Well, from that point on, I waited. Our other two children had gotten to the parking lot and were waiting with our son out in the parking lot. And they kept checking on me, but of course they couldn't come in. And I didn't really want to go out because I knew I probably wouldn't be able to come back in if I went out. So I waited for, it was probably 2 or 3 hours. And then the cardiologist came back and said, and I was like, could I just get my kids on the phone so you can tell us all at the same time? He was like, sure. So we were on speakerphone, and he just told us that he had had his main artery was 100% blocked. So they put a stent in, and he had lots of fluid also on his heart. So he was also in congestive heart failure. So they put a heart pump and a stent in his main artery, which was so strange to think. But at that time, you didn't know how the virus was affecting the blood. There were some thoughts of it, but nothing was totally out yet. So we just asked him, what are his chances? And he said, if he had just had a heart attack, I'd give him 50%. He said, but the fact that he has COVID and he's been intubated, he said, it's not good. And he said, I'm not really sure what his chances are. And he said, but I am a man of faith. And he goes, at this point, it's time to pray. And he said, that's where we'll do everything we can, but that's where it kind of comes in now. And we were like, okay, I mean, we could do that. And literally, I felt like he wanted to cry, and he wanted to give me a hug, but obviously we couldn't do that. So I waited until he got out and went up to ICU. They allowed me to walk up to ICU in the waiting room. I had to sign papers, and then they were like, okay, see you later. So I walked out the door, told my kids where to meet me, and, you know, got in the car with them, and we just all cried, you know, just like, well, this is it. And my older daughter, she goes, you know, can we pray? And I go, absolutely. And like Stuart had said, we had kept it pretty quiet because we live in a small community, and just didn't. There was so much unknown. It makes you feel literally like you have leprosy of some sort, and it just, you just didn't want people to be scared. And so we had kept it really quiet, but at that point I just said, if that's what we've got to do is pray, then I want to let everybody know, please pray with us. So on the way home from the hospital, that's what I did. I just said, all right, on social media, I'm like, okay, here's the deal. We've been dealing with this for 2 weeks now. He's had a heart attack, or he's in the hospital. He needs a miracle. And it was overwhelming how much the kindness of people came out. And, you know, the post was shared, and people were contacting us. And it was just amazing because obviously people couldn't come to you. You couldn't be around. Our family couldn't even come be with us. So we had no family, friends. It was just us four nonstop together for that month. And then once we got home, we came in, got everything inside, and I walked to the front, and the sun was coming up. And I was like, look at the sunrise. And then I looked outside, and one of our really good friends, which is also a neighbor, she's sitting across our driveway on a curb, and she's just got her Bible open and is just praying and reading scripture and just, you know, out loud. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, I can't, that's, you know, but she's just like, I don't know what else to do. And I think that was everybody. Nobody knew what to do. Everybody wanted to just come and be with you, but you couldn't because we were in quarantine. That lunchtime that day, there's a whole group of younger guys.
We call them the young bloods.
Yeah, Stuart calls them the young bloods. But they're all in ministry of some sort and just across the Atlanta area. And he's really invested in each one of them individually. And they were all like, can we do a Zoom prayer at noon? And I don't think they thought I would get on, but I'm like, what else have I got to do? So my youngest daughter and I jumped on the Zoom, and it was so kind, their prayers. And then from that day forward, because obviously the next 24 to 48 hours were very critical for him, they were like, let's pray him through the night. And for the next, until he came home, that whole group, every night, they each took like an hour and prayed every single night. It was amazing. It was amazing how that happened.
this is all like, and then this would go on, just kind of turn into days, turn into weeks, just kind
of. Yes. So the next 24, 48 hours, he started making progression. And we were like, oh my goodness. But we still knew he was incredibly critical. The first time anybody told me was that Easter weekend was that weekend. And the first time anyone told me a positive was on Easter Day, and it was the pulmonary doctor. His name is Dr. Jagadesh. And he's the first person that said, I think you'll survive. And I'm just like, the poor guy had no idea what he was getting, because I just started bawling on the phone. And he was like, you okay? I'm like, you're the first person that's told me that ever. And they said at that point, they're watching like their inner organs. And if their kidneys were still functioning, that's a positive sign that he would come out. So that led to one of the nurses that had him in the very beginning came after the weekend, came back to work, and she had made, because that Easter we went out and sat in the parking lot, and I'm just talking to him, because it's just like, what else do? You can't be with them, but you know, it was Easter, we wanted to be with them. And so we're just sitting in the parking lot, and I think the nurse had followed us on social media, so she saw that we were sitting in the parking lot. And she made this blue heart when she got back to work that week and put it in his window. But she thought it was a very simple gesture. For us, it was the kindest, it was life-giving. And because it was like, there he is, that's him. Because we knew he was on the fourth floor, we knew he was in room 7, but it's like, where's room 7? And it changed everything for me and my children and for our community and friends that loved him so much, to the point, you know, even like the next weekend, they had, and you guys participated, they had an online prayer every 30 minutes and someone sitting in the parking lot every 30 minutes on that Saturday. And those kind of situations are what held me and my children up through the whole process of it all.
And y'all would go pretty much back to the house every night. I mean, this was just the same thing over and over every day.
Yeah, and we didn't go every day. I started kind of going every day, but you know, we would all four of us would go different times. But and it might just be 30 minutes. I mean, there's nothing you could really do, but we would just go sit there and talk to him or pray or just sing worship songs. I mean, it was just declaring that, you know, God, we need to move. We need to move in room 7.
Yeah.
And because there was nothing else. The doctors were doing everything. And it was all up to God at that point.
Can you tell me, like, I know, you know, we were talking just the fact that it would be like you get a little bit of good news and then just kind of a crash of news. Like, what was the emotion for you? You know, you're in survival mode. What was like, you know, kind of tell me, like, what was it like to go from one extreme to the other? And how were you processing that?
The first time that happened was they extubated him, I think, on, like, the 15th of April. And we were just elated. And within 3 hours, the doctor calls back and says, I'm so sorry, but we've had to intubate him again. He got agitated and his oxygen level went down. And I was like, oh, that just like, your body, everything just drops, your heart, your stomach, everything. But that was how phone calls were. You never knew if you were going to get good news or if you were going to get horrible news. Because not only was, you know, his heart an issue, then they found out he had blood clots, then they found out that he had a horrible bacterial infection. His white blood counts were going, I mean, everything. Then the next weekend, they thought, and that was the weekend that everybody prayed, they thought they were going to extubate him again. And of course, it would be 24 more hours. And about the time that they thought we're going to do it, it was going to be on Monday morning. And for me, Mondays were always like just horrible days for some reason, because it seemed like everything changed.
Mondays are horrible days.
Everything changed on Monday, but that Sunday night, he had vomited in his ventilator, and come Monday, and I had gotten a text on that Friday from our palliative care doctor, and she said, I expect Stuart to not be in ICU when I get back on Monday. That was the last text I got from her on a Friday. And then on Monday, he basically had six doctors standing over his bed going, he's dying. What do we do? How is this healthy man dying and we can't figure it out? But it's just depravity. I mean, there's just not a better word to explain. Like, it goes from elation to a depravity, and just a phone call and just a couple hours can be, and you're just having to process that by yourself. Yeah. And we had gotten to the point where we wouldn't send everything out on social media, because a nurse might come in on one shift that had never seen him before, and she's basically looking, or he's looking at you like, he's horrible.
Right.
But the nurse that saw him the week before comes in and goes, oh my goodness, he looks so great. So there was so much controversy. So we just finally said, until the doctor tells us, we weren't going to tell other people know what was actually the status of the day. But it was hard because my children had to process that, their grief, via the world to see via social media. And it wasn't set up that way, but I just literally wanted people to pray. And then once people started responding, then you kind of felt like you needed to keep it going that way, because people were reaching out to you going, how's he doing? How's he doing? How's he doing?
Like, I don't know. I mean, it's always up and down.
And we would FaceTime, you know, he would give us hand motions every once in a while, but he says he doesn't remember it at all. But after that Sunday night that he threw up, I couldn't go back to sleep. And so I woke up that morning and I just walked outside, watched the sunrise. And I just felt like God and I had just a moment of, okay, this is it. This is it. We tried. And I don't think from the beginning, there was nothing inside of me or our children that did not think God could not heal him. We just didn't know if he would. We just didn't know if he would choose to. And Stuart said it a minute ago, but I don't know what the death toll is today. It's probably 130,000. I'm not sure. But we just kept thinking, he's no different than all the thousands of people that have died. There's nothing special about him over.
Continue.
And that, we just couldn't get that out of our head. Like, why would he choose to heal him and not everybody else? And my kids would get very offended when people would say, oh, his testimony is going to be so great. I can't wait to hear, you know, his testimony out of this. And my children were like, that's so cruel. That why would God put him through this to make his testimony better? And I just said, you know, I don't think that. And I finally started telling people, you know, I'm very confident that Stuart would have served God regardless if he had had COVID. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to change who he was or what he's going to do in the future or what he's done in the past. I mean, he was still going to be the same person.
Yeah, I think one of the things, because you really start to, you know, turn, we can talk some about the Stuart coming out, but I would love, you know, because this is your husband, and you're coming to grips with the reality that he may not survive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're kind of getting a lot of the, we know, you know, he's got a testimony, and he's going to be, you know, a lot of the proclamations. And I think y'all were talking about, you when you had that moment, that you actually had kind of resolved.
I had resolved that it, that it was not, that he wasn't going to survive.
And you had told your children when you were talking about this specifically. Can you recount that conversation?
I told my kids, we were standing in the kitchen, and I just said, I just want you guys to know that if Dad doesn't survive, that I'm okay. And I have been loved well, and I have felt more love in my life from him than 99.9% of the marriages in the world. And I am content. And I just wanted them to know and to feel how special our marriage was and our relationship, and that I had no regrets and that he had no regrets. And they all looked at me and said, Mom, we know. We know he loved you well, and we know you felt that way. So I just wanted them to have a peace of mind that regardless of if it did go the way we all felt, and I think we all felt, I think of the outside world that people were praying, we were so grateful, and like I said, that held us up many a days, but I don't think people understood how bad it was and how the phone calls would come and the different doctors and how they would just be like, no hope.
And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, we had talked about this. We didn't want to, you know, kind of go, oh, here's Stuart's testimony, right? That's not, but what I thought was so powerful about that for you and Kelly, I think it really is incredibly, one is it's profound, but it's incredibly important for those of us who follow Christ and are walking in faith to recognize that I'm going to be okay even if the worst happens, that doesn't jeopardize my faith. And that's what I really, you know, feel and believe we need to kind of lean into and wrestle with, because so often our, and you know, Stuart, I think that's what you're going to be talking about the next couple of weeks. And so if you guys want to jump in there and kind of pick up from there.
Yeah, we had already been having major discussions before I got sick about just what God was kind of stirring in both of us, that we have this propensity as the church in America to have placed our faith and trust in things that God hasn't necessarily promised us. That, you know, I don't think our faith falls apart because of doubt as much as it does of us placing our faith in the wrong things. And what the way Kelly has inspired me, and our children even have inspired me with this whole health crisis, is that it changes the way you pray. Because what we want to pray, and Kelly and I get tickled at this sometimes, because we actually, even since I've gotten out of the hospital, have been in environments where a faith leader almost yells at God while they're praying, declaring, and, you know, this is what you're going to do. Well, this is a heads up to all of us that are watching and listening. God doesn't promise us that he'll heal us. Says that he can, doesn't promise us that he will. And that changes the way you pray, because now you have to become submissive to this all-knowing, all-powerful God. To make a decision, will you choose to heal him? We know you can. We're not sure you will, which means he's still God. The other way is, this is what we know you're going to do, so you've made yourself God. And the thing that she has just blown me away by is through this whole ordeal, she kept continuously, consistently was going, I don't know if you will, but I believe that you can, and that's what I'm going to trust. Even to the point that morning on the porch, she just went, okay, you can have him if that's what you choose. But it's such a big deal to all of us in the room and those of you that are watching and listening, because I'm convinced, Mike, that there are brokenhearted people all across the country who have believed God for something that he never promised them. And now they're absolutely wrecked because God didn't come through. And that's just a dangerous place to live.
And the thing, too, I think what's so powerful, and I think your story just illustrates that, is that when we become so obsessed with trying to figure out how this is going to work out the way we want, that we actually miss so much of what God is actually doing in those moments that I think are some of the most precious things that we experience. Yes, trying to get out from underneath something.
I read a quote from a Romanian French playwright, and he says that over explanation separates us from astonishment. And what we want to do, especially as Jesus people, is we want an explanation
for everything.
For everything. And the harsh reality, all of us love miracles until we need one. You really don't want to have to go through a time where you need a miracle. Yeah. I promise you, she and our children would love to have that month and a half back where, but then to try to over-explain what happened, except to be able to say, God. And you're right. Over-explaining means that you miss the wonder and the astonishment of what happened. But miracles are happening all around us, too. It's even that powerful. C.S. Lewis said that miracles are a story written in small letters that the world has been telling in letters too large for some of us to see. The fact that, for example, right now while we're talking, we are on a blue marble rocketing through the universe at 67,000 miles an hour, rotating 1,000 miles around a gas ball, a ball of fire, while there's a moon that controls the sea, and you don't believe in a miracle?
Yeah. It's everywhere.
Do you look at the woman who's sitting beside me? This is a miracle. Miracles happen all the time. But the problem is we try to over-explain it. And I'm just so grateful that Kelly and our children went, we can't explain this, and we're also not going to try to explain if God chooses to take him.
I think that to me was what was so powerful, is that faith isn't contingent on that outcome. It's contingent on God, on what God, who he is and what he has said and what he loves and has availed life to us.
I didn't want our children to, as we walked through this, I didn't want them looking at me going, I was only going to worship God if he did heal him. Yep. You know, I wanted them to see that my relationship, my need of a relationship to God was regardless of whatever the outcome might be and whatever the day might include. Now, was I freaked out? Was I stressed out? Yes. I mean, my attention span was, I couldn't hold it, and I would just have to pull myself away and either read. I mean, I would just quote out loud Psalms 91 and just go, I declare. I mean, anything that I could think to do, I was doing it.
Yeah.
But I knew God had never promised me that. Right. He had not. People were calling me going, he's going to make it. He's going to make it. And I'm like, well, it's right. Good that you think that. But God has not told me that, and he hasn't promised me that.
And it was more, I assume, more than just positive thinking. It was doing something deep in your, when you're declaring these. You're not just trying to talk yourself into something. There's like some soul-sustaining power happening.
Yes. And to know that I knew that power.
Yeah.
I knew it was possible. But is that what he was going to do?
Right. I mean, and even in your own, even in sustaining you mm-hmm. with that uncertainty.
And I did feel that he would, whenever I'd pull away and I'm like, I need you right now. I would feel it. I would feel the presence and the calmness. But you know, that was numerous times a day. Just having to go through that.
Was this may be a little bit more than what you bargained for, but did the emotion range, did it get to anger? How would you describe the range?
I didn't feel I felt anger only towards the world.
Okay.
Explain
yeah,
why.
I will. Like, okay, for instance, here's the way that I felt. The first time we got out of quarantine and were able to go to Target for the first time, I literally cried the entire time we were in the store because
there was no toilet paper.
There probably wasn't any toilet paper, but the reason why was because everyone there thought the world's just still going on, like nothing's ever happened. Majority of the people weren't wearing masks. Majority of the people were not social distancing. I mean, it was just like nothing had changed in their life, and my world had just come crashing down. And I didn't feel like they had any respect for what I was going through. It's kind of how it felt.
Yeah.
But that was the only time I felt anger. I was much more just grateful and sad. I was really, really sad. I didn't feel anger until after he was home.
Right.
And then,
I'm just kidding.
Not at him, no. But I think all of me and all the children have felt a lot of anger that show up at, and I think in our opinion we felt like we talk to the doctors and the nurses so much, and what they literally have to go through nonstop every day, and that they're putting their lives at risk to take care of. Yeah. Our loved one, my husband, I told them every single time when a new one would come on a shift, I'm like, what's your name? And they would tell me their name, and we would write it on a piece of paper on our wall. And I have all that, and we still have the paper. I won't let Stuart throw it away. But of every nurse or every doctor that took care of him. And I would say, we are praying for you for the entire shift. And I'm going to tell everybody what your name is that's praying for Stuart so they can pray for you specifically by name. And me and my children want you to know how grateful we are that you're choosing to put your life and your family's life on the line to come in and take care of him. Mm. And so that part, I knew what was going on at the hospital.
Right.
And when America... in general, I'm just saying in general, when people can't just appreciate that and disrespect the healthcare professionals for what they're going through, that's anger.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because I know what they did for us. And, you know, it was very personal. And that's when it changes you, is when it becomes personal.
Yeah. That's so good, because it is. I mean, that's what you guys have talked about, just the effort that they made to save your husband.
People don't, Kelly got it. They just put a picture up of that heart.
Right.
Those same healthcare, whether it's nurses or doctors, the heart that hung in my window as I was leaving ICU or leaving the hospital, actually, they all signed it. And we now have that hanging up in our house.
Yeah.
I tell him and I tell our family and anybody that asks, those are like our 12 stones.
Oh.
So that heart is, because God moved. He did something. And I never, ever want to forget.
Mm.
I don't want to forget. I don't want my children to forget. He doesn't really remember anything.
I was in a drug cartel fight somewhere in Mexico.
But that I did want to make some type of monument, I guess, that we would always have because of what the sacrifice of human beings did for us, as well as what our God did for us.
Yeah. And I mean, Kelly got an opportunity once I was in ICU and started coming out of the fog. Our palliative care doctor at one point said, what Stuart needs most at this point is to be able to hug you and kiss you and for you to be close, which was a great call on her part because I did need that. But she had to go through the same process that nurses and doctors, and most people don't realize this, it's a 10-minute process of just putting everything on to go into a room. And then you have to take it off.
Right.
before you can leave, and then you have to put it back on. So it's, Kelly's so right. It's just so disrespectful for those of us who think, first of all, that it's a conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
And secondly, to those men and women who are risking their life for the behalf of the, Jesus said it best. There's no greater love than someone that would lay down their life for a friend. Yeah. And that's the way we feel about those men and women who fought for me.
Yeah, I think that's such a great reminder just for us to be mindful, you know, of everybody that we know, a lot of our family and friends and such that are that work or know people in those, to really take the time to do that. So Stuart, really take some time. I know we're going to kind of wrap up here in a few minutes, but tell me, like, let's talk about the next couple of weeks and what you want for us to do to prepare for that.
Yeah, and I don't want to let too much out of what I want to talk about the next 2 weeks, but this is certainly something that Kelly and I have been wrestling with before I got sick. And then now especially, we feel very, very, very strongly that I feel like an idol isn't an idol because it has some particular property or value. An idol is an idol because of the value we place on it. And I am convinced that the greatest idol we have in the American church is certainty. And so for the next 2 weeks, I'm going to talk about that idea of how do we place our faith and trust in Jesus and not the things that we think we're supposed to be certain of, because so much of life is uncertain.
Yeah.
It's interesting. The writer of Hebrews says that Jesus is the same today, yesterday, and forever. He doesn't say your circumstances are. He doesn't say your health will be. He doesn't say your marriage is. He doesn't say your children will be. He doesn't say your country will be. He says he is. And so what does it mean for us to fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith? What does it mean for us to follow him? And I've said this in a couple of interviews. I love how C.S. Lewis phrased this when he was talking about Aslan. He said about Aslan, who is the picture of Jesus for us in his books, he said, he's not safe, but he's good. He's dangerous, but he's good. And it makes sense why so many of us would much rather worship certainty than we would a dangerous God. So what does that mean? That's kind of where we're going for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. Cool. I saw your notes and earlier, and you had a quote on there from Bob Goff. Could you, like, read it? I don't even know what it is.
That's mine.
Oh, sorry. I was, like, trying to peek in.
I can't. You read it, because I don't know that I can see it.
Okay.
I saw his notes. I'm curious as to what he was talking about.
This was something that I read on, it was either Easter or that Monday.
Okay.
When things were, no, sorry, not Easter. The Monday, it was the Sunday or the Monday when the doctors were, like, standing over him going,
okay,
he's dying, until before, and then he had a plasma exchange and then everything changed for him.
Yeah.
So, the kidney doctor actually saved my life, mm-hmm, because he stood in that room. He just happened to be in the room that day and called Kelly and said, I don't know if it'll make a difference, but I'd like to try this plasma exchange.
Yeah.
And you don't have anything to lose because he's dying.
Right.
And she's like, sure. They were planning to do three. Before the end of the first day, I got a plasma exchange. She says I was a different person.
Wow.
They only had to do two. And the third day, they were planning to extubate me, and then they're rolling me out of ICU at some point.
Wow.
But there were actually two Bob Goff quotes. One, she reminded our children. I had sent them this because, yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. Here's the Bob Goff quote. Quote, hope doesn't go to sleep just because it's dark outside. It lights a candle and stays up waiting for the rest of the story. Are you living in anticipation of God surprising you?
Mm.
He finds us in the places between the miracles.
That's what he gave me that day. And I'm like, all right,
yeah.
I can't lose hope.
Yeah.
I can't, even though I was in the dark.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what the hope meant. I didn't know I wasn't sure. But then, so that happened on like a Sunday or a Monday, and then everything changed that week. Yeah. And so part of me now, looking back, is going, God was just, he was just like working in my heart and just giving me hope. He was just loving on me in a sweet and gentle way of going, it's going to be okay. But at that moment, I didn't know,
right,
because I was in the dark.
Yeah.
And I was just in between the anticipating the miracle.
In between the miracles. What a great thing. Well, listen, I just want to say thank you to both of you. One is, and I've told Stuart this over the years, but thank you for your voice into our church, into my life, into our church. And Kelly, thank you, you know, for being willing to do this today. I know it's not easy to kind of recap everything and recount everything, especially even as you're still processing with you and the kids what has actually unfolded over the last few months. And I'm going to look forward to hearing from you next week, Stuart, and the week after. And so I'm going to wrap up, and we're going to pray for them. And just thank you guys so very much for being willing to share your story with us, okay? All right. God, I thank you for this time. I thank you for Stuart and Kelly, for Grant, for Cameron, and for Chandler. And just want to pray your continued provision for them in as sustaining and healing and all the things that need to unfold and that will unfold. And we just thank you for the reminder that you are faithful in the middle when things aren't working out like we want, that you are faithful. And just remind us of that, Father. We thank you that you have given us a gospel in the name and in the way of your Son, Jesus, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. It can be depended on and counted on. And Father, I just want to ask that you just use this to encourage all of us, people who are going through really difficult things and need that miracle or that hope in between the miracle, that you would sustain and bring that to them. And Father, I thank you for that. I lift all of this to you in the name of your Son, Jesus, who is our King. Amen. Thank you guys for joining us online today. And we'll continue on in the gallery with some conversations, some follow-ups. So we'll join them over there. Thank you guys so much.